All the online spaces were discontinuous. There was the Well, CompuServe, AOL, but they were all separate dial-up universes. To go from one site to another, you had to hang up the phone and make another call and listen to this crazy sound that the modem would make, and then hopefully you would get a connection. It took so much work to move from one place to another. You really had to be committed to find anything useful on it. Jim Clark. The web's original genesis was with Tim Berners-Lee as a means for physicists to share publications and to pass around written documents of that sort. HTML and all of the hypertext transfer protocol that is used is basically a format for passing around these documents, for shipping them electronically to other people. Alex Totik. Everything was academic on the Internet. It was all .edus. It was not that interesting. Stephen Johnson. And then, starting in 1993 or 1994, you started to hear word about Mosaic, this new browser that was here, but we didn't really know what that meant. Sergey Brin. I used Mosaic at the time. I tinkered with it like a hobby. It was more of a fun thing to do than an, oh, this is going to change the world. Brian Bellendorf. In the early days, the Internet was really small. Everybody knew everybody. Researchers, programmers, people working in academia. Stephen Johnson. And then the Mosaic browser becomes Netscape. Suddenly you had a unified front end for the Internet. Netscape was founded by two people, Jim Clark and Mark Anderson. At the time, Jim Clark was already a Silicon Valley legend. In grad school in the 70s, Clark had worked out the fundamental math behind what eventually came to be called virtual reality. In the 80s, he put all that math into a silicon chip, which became the basis for Silicon Graphics Incorporated, SGI, one of the decade's highest-flying computer companies. Then in the 90s, Clark abruptly quit SGI and teamed up with Mark Andreessen, a young Silicon Valley newbie, to form Netscape. The mission was to rebuild and reimagine the NCSA Mosaic browser. They were going to drag the web out of its ivory tower. Howard Rheingold. Jim Clark is sort of like who Bob Taylor was to Doug Engelbart. He found this guy who had an idea and really made it happen. Jim Clark. At the end of 93, I was just finishing my 12th year after founding and starting Silicon Graphics with a group of my graduate students from Stanford. SGI was a company that primarily made what would now be called a graphics processing unit. The company grew to be quite large, $4 billion a year and 10,000 employees. Mark Andreessen. Silicon Graphics at that time was what Google is today. The best technology company in the valley. It was the one that everyone wanted to work at. They were just phenomenal technologists with phenomenal products. Jim Clark. SGI was a hardware business, and it became a workstation business, and we ended up being the biggest high-end workstation company out there. Mark Anderson. It was just a great company. John Gianandrea. Jim was like this macho kind of hardware guy. He would come into the lab late at night and say, "What the fuck is this? And why is this not going?" That was how he ran things. Jim Clark. I was sufficiently disruptive in that context, with that board of directors, with that management, that if I had pushed it much further, I would have gotten fired like Steve Jobs got fired. And it was my company. I taught it everything it knew about graphics, literally. John Gianandrea. He just became very frustrated. It was pretty clear that he didn't have control of the strategy of the company. Jim Clark. I decided instead to call a board meeting and on the phone, resigned. I told them I was not going to compete. I would not actively recruit from the company and I was not going to stay on the board. John Gianandrea. And so then he left. That was a big thing when Jim left. Jim Clark. The last day I was there, a fellow came by my office to say goodbye, and I said, "I do not know what I am going to do. Every single high-quality engineer I have ever met, I recruited here." I made a commitment to not try to recruit them wherever I go, and I do not have any ideas about what I'm going to do. He says, "You should call Mark Andreessen." I said, "Who is that?" He went over, he pulled a web browser down from University of Illinois, opened a search, and typed, "Mark Andreessen." It came up with this page, and he says, "There you go, just read that," and walked away. Mark Andreessen. Mosaic was very successful, and so I had gotten a whole bunch of job offers coming out of school. I had spent my whole life in the Midwest, so I knew I wanted to be on a coast. So it was either East Coast or West Coast. All the interesting job offers in my field came from the West Coast, which I guess is not surprising, and so I came out to Palo Alto, and I went to work at a small networking company in Palo Alto called EIT. In fact, I was still getting job offers because in Mosaic there was an area in the help menu that said, "About the author," and it was my resume that was automatically generating job offers. Jim Clark. I clicked around, I found Mark's email, sent him an email right there saying, "This is Jim Clark. You may not know who I am, but I am the founder of Silicon Graphics, and if you know me, you know that the news has come out that I am leaving Silicon Graphics. I would like to start a new company. I would like to know if you would like to get together and join me to talk about that." 10 minutes later, he responded, "Mark Andreessen." I said, "I know who you are." Jim Clark. We thrashed around literally for months, meeting a couple of times a week. My wife would cook dinner, and we would drink some nice wine and talk about things. We became pretty well acquainted. He had respect for me, and I developed an increasing respect for him. Jim Barksdale. My wife Sally would work on his table manners. He dressed like a kid and acted like a kid, but he had a great sense of humor. He was so engaged and engaging. Jim Clark. After about March of 94, somewhere in that time frame, Mark says, "Well, I do not know, but we have to do something if we want to recruit my friends out of the University of Illinois, because they are all interviewing for jobs right now." And I said, "Well, what do you want to do? Have you got any ideas?" Mark Andreessen. Remember, this is in early 94. The prevailing view in the business world and in the world at large was, the Internet is not a commercial medium and will never be a commercial medium. It's not for consumers. Ordinary people won't use it, and there's no money to be made on it. John Gianandrea. There was this sense at the time that it was a weird university thing and that it wasn't serious. Jim Clark. The world was basically saying, "You are crazy. You cannot make money on the Internet. It's free." Mark Andreessen. We were talking one day and we said, "Well, this Internet thing, no one takes it seriously, but it's growing vertically." Jim Clark. All I had to do was look at the growth of Mosaic for a year and see that it grew to 1 million users, and I figured there was a network effect of people getting online. Mark Andreessen. The idea was to basically do a new version of Mosaic, but from scratch, and in particular, do it as a real product. Jim Clark. I said, "Okay, let's hop on a plane and go out and recruit your buddies." Alex Totic. Then Mark calls, "Hey, we're flying in. I think we're doing it. We're going to do the Mosaic Killer." Jim Clark. The first night we were there, we got together for pizza with the entire group of guys that ended up founding the company. Even Lou Montulli came in from Kansas. All the guys that had built Mosaic were there. Lou Montulli. Jim got us super excited. He's a very energetic, charismatic person when he wants to be, and he was giving us the full sell. He changed our perspective from, "We just want to keep working on the web," to, "We are going to go to Silicon Valley. We're going to change the fabric of the universe, and we're going to basically rule the planet." To have somebody like that believe in us and want to work with us to go change the world is very exciting. We were excited. I was personally very excited. Alex Totic. We would have these fantasies. Let's have a company called com.com.com. and live on a boat somewhere, and it'll be awesome. And then it happens. Jim Clark. I said, "Great, I will put $3 million in, and I will hire the whole team." I made myself the CEO and printed all of these stock agreements and offer letters, one with each guy's name, and everyone signed them, and we were off to the races. John Gianandrea. Jim Clark was very clever because he took all of the young people that knew anything about the web, literally flew around in his jet, picking up these people, saying, "Hey, I have a job for you in California." Alex Totic. A week later, we're in California, driving down 101. We saw Oracle, Sun, SGI, and I was like, how come no one told me about this place before? This is awesome. It was like the Mecca. John Gianandrea. And then he paired them with seasoned people from SGI. So the first 20 or 22 employees were a mixture of people right out of school who knew the leading-edge thing on what was going on with the web. And then also these seasoned engineers. The SGI DNA was there. And that was the magic that kind of worked. Jim Clark. I did not have a financial plan, and there was no way I was going to take the time to write a financial plan. I was running on instinct about what the network effect could be. I thought, if we can get a couple million people using our product pretty quickly, there is going to be money to be made. The leap of faith that large numbers of people using your product is going to yield a profit does not seem to me like rocket science, but it did then. Alex Totic, we didn't know how to make money. Our money-making vision was not as strong as our engineering vision. Jamie Zawinski, give it away and make it up in volume. Well, no, originally we had two software products. We had a web browser and we had a web server. Lou Montulli, our original plan was to give the browser away for free or for near free and make all of our money on enterprise server software. We were going to give away the razors, and the razor blades were going to be our web server, and our commerce server, and all the other servers we were going to create. Netscape's give away the razor and sell the blades strategy was almost immediately put into jeopardy. A rival team, Apache, was planning to make sure there would always be a free alternative to the server software that Netscape was developing. Free razor blades for Netscape's free razors. Apache wasn't even a company. It was a group of part-time developers led by Wired's webmaster, Brian Bellendorf, who took the backer ethos that information should be free to heart. Bellendorf's motives were as high-minded as they come, but his arrows were aimed squarely at Netscape's business model. Brian Bellendorf. There was an email sent to this list of users saying, unfortunately, we have bad news. The entire NCSA Mosaic development team has been hired by this new company called Netscape. The good news is that now the web will be commercial. Now the web will have official support. Now there will be a company that you can buy a product from and that will sell you support. And if you have any problems, you will be able to call a number. And you will get that all for the low, low price of a couple of $1,000s per server. It did not quite say that, but that was the implication. Jim Clark. The instant response was, you guys are crazy and we hate you because you are going to ruin the internet. Brian Bellendorf. We did not want the web to be owned by anybody and felt that, at least at the layer of web protocols, getting pages to people, we felt like the web server is like the printing press. All of us were running our own printing operations, building interesting websites, building interesting stuff. We just did not want to wake up one morning and find out that we had to start paying a tax to do the things that we had been doing for free before. It was very much an idealism kind of thing. It was inherited from where a lot of internet technology had come from, which is this idea that tech should be public and distributed. It is not necessarily the same point of view as saying all software should be free. Jim Clark. I said, you do not get it. The only way the internet is going to be is if it is financed by businesses and operated by businesses, because the government cannot continue to put money into it ad nauseam. It has to be a commercial medium. The gnashing of teeth. The wailing. And I got so much hate mail and nasty emails that you just would not believe it. Brian Bellendorf. We were happy to see that these college students were getting real jobs, I guess, but at the same time a little sad, like, well, okay, NNCSA's server software continues to work for us, and if we continue to fix bugs and add features to it, do we need Netscape? So I set up an email list, and we started saying, should we give it a different name? It is obviously not the NCSA web server anymore. Maybe we should call it something else. So we called ourselves Apache and figured out how to coordinate our efforts. We, being a core team that was still 10 or 12 people strong, even on day one, and grew to a couple hundred pretty quickly. Meanwhile, back at Netscape, Jim Clark, by June of 94, everyone was showing up. There was already a team of 8 to 10 people, administrators. We were in full swing. Over the course of the summer, I began to worry about running out of money because we were building up people. I only had maybe $15 million to my name, and I had already put in three. And so I did not have a whole lot more money I could afford to put in it. What we needed was to get the product done. Jamie Zawinski. When I decided to take the job at Netscape, I thought I'd been working really hard. Turns out I didn't really know what working hard was yet. It was a lot of work. Alex Totik. It was great. Since we were all in the office all the time, there was no calendar. You met several times a day and basically went over what's going on and where are we going next. I think I was drinking 12 Cokes a day at that time. Or more. You lived on Coke and not too much else. Every once in a while when your body broke down completely, then you would take a day off and you would say, I'm not coming in today. And you would sleep all day. That would just go on and on and on. John Gianandrea. General Magic was more intense, but the initial 6 months or year at Netscape were crazy. Jamie had a particularly hard job. Jamie Zawinski. At the time, I was living in Berkeley and commuting to Mountain View, so I was only going home every other day. I'd either just stay awake for a day and a half, or while I was waiting for some code to compile, I'd take a nap in my chair. John Gianandrea. He had an Aeron chair, an extra-wide version, and he would sit cross-legged in his armchair, easily, and he would be programming with no shoes on, and he would have a pair of big headphones on, playing thrash music of some kind, loud enough that you could hear it through the headphones. And when he was taking a break, you would put a blanket over his head and sleep like that, with the music going. Lou Montulli. I have never had a more productive time in my entire life. A great deal of that was I could dedicate all my energy to it every waking moment and not think about anything else because I had no distractions to pull me away at all. We were able to just get stuff done amazingly fast. I wrote about 30,000 lines of code in 3 months. That is a ridiculous amount. I would not recommend it. It worked in that very specific circumstance. Jim Clark. Toward the end of the summer, I wrapped up the financing and we began to recruit some management to help. Then the University of Illinois began to rattle sabers, claiming we were violating their intellectual property and implying that we were illicit and illegitimate. People at the University of Illinois had a lot of animosity toward us because we were absconding with their crown jewels and going to make money on them. Lou Montulli. We were essentially doing a new implementation, a re-implementation of something we already knew very well, Mosaic. Our goal was to create a brand new web browser from the ground up, but we already knew what it should look like and we basically knew how it should perform. We had all written the code once already. Jim Clark. I had spent some energy trying to get everything smoothed out, and I wanted to pay them some kind of a fee just so they would be quiet. They would not take it. Well, they would, but they wanted it in the form of 50 cents a copy, and we were planning to give it away for free. I was not going to pay anyone 50 cents a copy when I was going to allow everyone to download it for free. That is a quick way to go out of business. Meanwhile, they gave Microsoft a paid-up copy for a couple of $1 million. Alex Totik. Microsoft gets the license. They have our old Mosaic code. We were worried. If we had our old code, we would be really farther ahead than we are right now. But the old code sucks. So maybe not. The new Netscape code was much better. So it's like our own code versus our own code. Jamie Zawinski, we all believed very strongly that shipping fast was really, really important because there were other people who were trying to do the same thing we were. So we had to be first and we had to be best. That was our goal. First being the higher priority. Lou Montulli, the last part of the release process is the most stressful because it is constant back and forth with bugs and just trying to get this thing right. And it is the most frustrating time because bugs sometimes take an indefinite, unknown period of time to work out. And you are like pulling your hair out and trying to find this thing. And then you have the aha moment. And you do not know if the aha moment will be 10 minutes from now or a day and a half from now. It is really that kind of CSI moment. You have to find this thing within a couple hundred thousand lines of code, which is difficult. Jamie Zawinski, it's incredibly stressful. The days leading up to it were a lot of sleepless nights. The bug list is still long, but we have to decide if we are going to delay this release because of this bug or not. If there's a bug and someone has a fix, we have to sit there and argue about whether it's safe to put that fix in. Is there a chance that this fix is going to destabilize other things and make it worse? So there's a lot of waiting and panicking. Lou Montulli, Jamie and I were very close. Then I started to notice this more annoying side. Especially in meetings, he would just be really abrasive about things. He was famous for sending out flaming emails. How dare you do this to me? You are wasting my time and you are a complete asshole for doing this. And do not ever fucking do it again or else I am just going to get really upset. So those sorts of messages, and almost to that extent of meanness. I know he is a nice person inside, but he just could not help himself on that sort of stuff. I had gotten several of these, and more often than not, he was directing his flames at me. Jamie Zawinski, all of us who worked at Netscape in the early days were terrible to each other. We were all really abrasive people. We did most of our negotiation by screaming and insulting. Not necessarily the most healthy environment, but that's how it was. Lou Montulli, it was 3 a.m. I was at the end of one of those double-day binges. Jamie had just done the same thing, and he had sent out a flaming email and went to lunch or dinner or something, wherever you can get a hamburger at 2 a.m. I was just fed up with it. I virtually never do this, but I just sent back an email that said, "Here is the problem. It was really your fault." And then I was really not nice. And I said something like, "I really feel bad for all the people who have to work with you." It was bad. I was just trying to give it back to him so he could understand how I felt. And this was right at the end of the release process, so it had been boiling up. John Gianandrea. Montulli and Jamie were needling each other, but Jamie was under so much stress and is a very emotional person and probably hadn't had enough sleep. Alex Tutik. Jamie, he was temperamental. He coded well. He was different from us. He was more flamboyant. We were just pretty much corn, straight corn. He had the funny look. He had an image. He had a sense of style, which was fairly foreign to us. Jim Clark. He had half of his head shaved. Some stylistic statement on his part. I completely ignored it. It did not matter to me. I did not give a hoot. He was a great programmer, brilliant young guy. I do not think anyone bothered. People have just got to realize that a computer geek is respected on the basis of how much code he can write and the quality of code he can write. People do not give a crap what he looks like. If you generate good code quickly, no one cares. Jamie made everyone a lot of money. Jamie Zawinski. We were there a lot. Tempers ran high. Like I said, we were not friendly people to each other. Lou Montulli. So it was boiling up, so I sent this email and I went over to the cube next to me, to my friend Garrett Blythe, and I said, "Read it, read it." And he reads it and he is giggling and we hear Jamie walk in and we're listening and we hear him come in, log into his computer, and then he starts typing really loudly, like really loud and vigorous, vigorous typing. Garrett and I know exactly what's happening. Oh, this is going to be great. It's going to be amazing flame coming back. I just cannot wait to read this. And we tried to take it in a good spirit, and right in the middle of the furious typing, we hear this sound. This very distinctive sound of a computer booting up, or rebooting in this particular case, for no particular reason at all. He's typing furiously, and then his computer, for no reason at all, just reboots, which means everything that he's worked on just disappeared. So you hear the ding, you hear this slight pause, and then you hear, what? What the fuck? And then he had this wall, this pyramid of Coke cans that was at least 20 layers deep that was built up on this table next to his desk, and it went up above the cube wall. And you hear this crash as all the Coke cans come off the desk in a sweep. And then this really loud sound to our left. And then Jamie storms off. Jamie Zawinski. Lou was taunting me about something, and I lost it. I kicked a chair, and I walked out. Lou Montulli. Garrett and I get up, and we turn the corner. And there is Eric Bina with a chair, like, literally jutting out of the wall right next to his head. Apparently what happened is Jamie got up, picked up his chair, and threw it over his head out of his cube. Eric had come around because he heard the Coke cans, and the chair went right by his head and embedded itself into the wall. It was quite a scene. John Gianandrea. He threw a chair, and we sent him home. Jim Barksdale. It was a big deal. We even had T-shirts printed up that showed the chair and the wall. Jamie Zawinski. We made a T-shirt that had a coat of arms, and there was a chair in the middle of it. Yeah, because we were jerks, and we taunted each other that way. That's it. That's the whole fucking story. Lou Montulli. After that incident, he essentially went into his cube behind this thing, this large camo thing which he used to cover a tank or a plane that was hung up over his cube, and he never talked to any of us ever again. It was kind of the end of the social world, at least between me and Jamie and the core team. It was a highly charged event. I do not fault him for any of it. I certainly provoked it as much as he did. It was right at the end of our release process, the beta release, the very first beta release. We had been working 4 or 5 or 6 months, 7 days a week, 120 hours a week, and all of our core motivation was to get it out into people's hands. Because if nobody is using it, it is essentially mental masturbation, right? The end result has to be this thing that people can use. The first Netscape browser was released into the wild as a beta, or experimental version, in October 1994. Lou Montulli. So we are very, very excited, and we all got in a conference room to celebrate the release. We were going to watch as people downloaded it live, and we kind of figured out how to do that. Jamie Zawinski. There's a log file showing each download, and one of the guys rigged up a little script to parse that log file as it was scrolling by. John Gianandrea. I don't know why, I just did it, and people thought it was kind of cool. Alex Totic. We had a different sound effect for different downloads. Each different browser got its own sound bite. There was a frog, a cannon, and shattered glass. We're in a darkened room kind of watching the monitor log, and there's nothing on the log. Then the first download came from Australia. It took him a long while. He got half of it, then he had to restart. And then it finally went boom, the first download, cheers, champagne, beer, and all of it. A few minutes later, the next one comes, and then a few minutes later, the next one, and it gets faster and faster. John Gianandrea. It started off as a trickle, and then it became a flood, and eventually it's just deafening. Alex Totic. 6 hours later, we're still there, and it's like boom, crash, boom, crash. It's an avalanche, and it's never slowed down since. Lou Montulli. I don't want to toot my own horn, but it was really good software. We were very proud of it. In the modern experience, going from any other browser to Netscape would be the equivalent of going from your flip phone to an iPhone kind of experience. Like, wow, this finally works the way it's supposed to work. We were 10 times faster. We had a lot more features. It was a lot more polished. Images became a lot more practical on a web page. Before Netscape, you would wait minutes before you saw anything. We changed that completely. With Netscape, images would appear 10 times faster because the content would all stream in dynamically. Stephen Johnson. So what had just been text-based pages suddenly had images. This was the point which the web stopped just feeling like an interesting new format for data and really started to look like media. You could start to imagine that this was something that could become a magazine that you could put advertising on, or maybe the kind of intimate media of your own personal pictures. I remember looking at Netscape and thinking, oh, I can learn this and publish my own magazine with basically no distribution costs. That was just mind-blowing. Lou Montulli. The next step was to introduce those elements which allow for dynamically driven web content, allow for video, audio, a full programming language as a plug-in within the browser. Netscape started to lay the groundwork for the dynamic web that we know of today. We started to treat the web more like an application rather than a series of pages. Mark Andreessen. Think of each website as an application, and every single click, every single interaction with that site is an opportunity to be on the very latest version of that application. Lou Montulli. The whole metaphor of moving through the web page to page is now disrupted, and you have a complete application written in HTML on the one page of your browser, which is really important. This allows you to deliver truly immersive apps in a web browser, which changes fundamentally how software is delivered. Stephen Johnson. The internet was an asterisk that evolved into this browser-driven second platform. It kept Microsoft from being the dominant quasi-monopolistic force that we all thought it would become. Lou Montulli. You can see very clearly there is a correlation between the decline of Microsoft's power and the increase of the open web. We knew that would happen. Stephen Johnson. And because no one owned the open web, it unlocked this period of unbelievable creativity and innovation. It was not just variations on a theme. Whole new categories of software were created. User-created and curated encyclopedias, social media, and a million other ideas. Suddenly a couple sitting in the proverbial garage could come up with something and change everything again. Like Larry and Sergey starting Google, or Biz and Jack starting Twitter, or even Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook. John Doerr. The greatest legal creation of wealth in the history of the planet. Stephen Johnson. It all happened remarkably quickly. All the exciting things and all the vast new fortunes began to be created on the open web. Bob Taylor. The World Wide Web opened up the internet like nothing before, and the browser made all of that a lot easier. The Netscape web browser was an unprecedented success, as was the Apache web server. And yet, the two were like matter and antimatter, by all rights unable to exist in the same economic universe. Apache was giving away the server software that Netscape had planned to sell in order to keep the browser free. Paradoxically, it all worked out. The solution? An inspired bit of what Silicon Valley likes to call social engineering. John Andrea. It was a somewhat sneaky idea. Lou Montulli. We had put a price tag on the browser, but with kind of a wink-wink. We were really saying, well, if anyone wants to download it, just download it. It was freely available. Mark Andreessen. There was a clause in the license that said if you use it for business, you have to pay for it. John Gianandrea. The core engineers, the Jamies of the world, were a little bit ambivalent. They said, this is not okay. We are going back on our word. Because Mark had said things like it would always be free. And now we were parsing that a little bit. Lou Montulli. But what it meant was our salespeople could call up virtually any business in the world and say, we noticed you are using our software. Would you like to pay for it? and they would say, oh, yeah, sure, sure. It was not very expensive. It was $20 or something. It had a more expensive price, but the discounting made it very cheap as a dollar per person. People were like, yeah, absolutely, it is useful software. We love it. We will give you money. And our revenues just ballooned. It was ridiculous. Mark Andreessen. The browser was intended to be a loss leader, but revenue shot up like a rocket because that split license worked. I mean, we never expected browser revenue to get that high. We always thought that would be free. Jim Clark. Our revenue started going up exponentially, and I started seeing that we were going to be profitable that first year. I thought, well, this is wild. We should just take this thing public. Jim Barksdale. We decided to go in May. We hired the bankers. We did the necessary filings. We went on the road show. You could sense the momentum building as we went from city to city. The word was getting hot. The newspapers were covering it a lot. The Wall Street Journal was talking about it, and everybody else, wondering what this new IPO was going to do. We were a brand new company, less than a year old. Back then, the conventional wisdom was that you had to have at least 3 years of solid financial data in order to go public. We didn't. We had a couple of quarters and some projections, which I thought were conservative, and they proved to be. It was getting exciting. In London, which was our last stop, we got to the end of it. Mr. Barksdale, what is going to happen when Microsoft just bundles the browser into their product? I said, well, sir, there are two ways to make money in this world, bundling and unbundling. We have to catch a flight. Maybe another day I'll go through that with you. We laughed at that one. Alex Todick, we had no idea what we were doing. All of this stuff was improv. The long working hours, the releasing of it on the Internet, not having a business model to start off with, the IPO, all of this stuff. We were doing it because we didn't know any better. Jim Clark, I remember the day we went public. I was worth $663 million at the close of market that day. So I put a tail number on my airplane of 663, Mike November, and I began to build that boat, Hyperion. Jim Barksdale. Jim was interested in boats. He had this idea of building this computerized boat, the Hyperion. It was single-masted, the tallest mast in the world. Jim Clark. It had the tallest mast in the world until John Williams, this real estate guy in Atlanta, decided he was going to build a bigger one. He made his mast 1 meter taller. Hyperion had 8 crew and 3 bedrooms. It was meant as a jewel box. It's a real work of art inside. It is 150 feet long, which sounds big, but it is not that big on a sailboat. To get to the size where you have another deck above on a sailboat, you are getting into the 300-foot range. That is what I have now, a 300-foot, three-masted schooner, Athena. Lou Montulli. It never even occurred to me that people could make this much money. I made probably $20 or $30 million, something like that. But it did seem absurd to me, and in some ways I felt a little numb. This cannot be real. This money cannot actually be there. Jamie Zawinski. It was just a joke. Actually, my favorite joke from IPO day, it turns out Jerry Garcia died on the day of the Netscape IPO. So the very first joke I heard when I walked in that day was, what were Jerry Garcia's last words? Jerry Garcia. Netscape opened at what? A fish, a barrel, and a gun. Suck perfects the art of snark. In a manifesto that accompanied the first issue of Wired, editor-in-chief Louis Rossetto predicted a digital revolution that would whip through our lives like a Bengali typhoon. Remarkably, the deluge showed up just as Rossetto promised. 1995 was the year that toys started to talk. It was the year that the web awoke. From his vantage point, Rossetto could clearly see that the new medium was going to create a new crop of media moguls. And if he plotted his course right, he could join them. It didn't happen. Instead, Rossetto was upstaged by two mutinous employees, Carl Stedman, and Joey Enough. Disgusted with Wired, and especially Hotwired, Rossetto's attempt at an online media empire, the two 20-somethings secretly decided to launch a Hotwired killer while still working for Rossetto. Suck was cynical, anonymous, and gleefully Marxian, the anti-Wired. Yet it was produced in Wired's offices and served out on Wired's bandwidth, and it established a format, set a pace, and adopted a tone that came to define the World Wide Web. Kevin Kelly. If Wired had been done in like 1989, it wouldn't have made it. It would have been too early. Wired came just right at the dawn of the web, and everybody kind of woke up and said, oh my gosh, now I get it. I need this magazine to understand what's happening. Louis Rossetto. We had no reference to the World Wide Web in the first issue of Wired. Kevin Kelly. We were accused of being completely clueless about the Internet because we had no mention of the Internet in the first issue. But I was so tired of talking about the well and the Internet that I didn't want to talk about it in Wired. We actually didn't want it to feel like it was about the Internet. We wanted it to feel like it was about this broader culture. And so we avoided it. Maybe that omission seemed like an oversight, but it was on purpose. Are you serious? I remember when Wired started their conference on the well. People didn't talk so much about how the Internet was changing the world. They were already imagining virtual reality right around the corner and stuff like that. Brian Bellendorf. At Wired in the summer of 93, I was setting up a website, but I was also fixing bugs. I was adding features and sending them upstream over this email list to the kids at the University of Illinois building. This, along with everyone else, the other users, and we were trading these fixes like baseball cards. This was kind of like the Brownian motion of how technology improvement took place in the early days of the web. Louis Rossetto. It was only in the second issue that we had a small news item in the front talking about Tim Berners-Lee in Geneva. That was the first mention of the web in our magazine, but not the last. Then it became something we were paying attention to. Howard Rheingold. And so Lewis thought, okay, let's create a web-based cultural publication that we'll make money on. One of Lewis's admirable traits was that he thought really, really, really big. Louis Rossetto. The magazine people were having a ball. The advertising people were selling ads hand over fist. So the Hotwired thing was a complete flyer. We had a meeting where we sat down and said, this is what we're doing. We will create the first website that has original content and Fortune 500 advertising. Brian Bellendorf. I was impressed with that, but none of them had deep experience, or any experience really, with the Internet. Louis Rossetto. So let's find out what it is. The mandate for Hotwired was, what is original content made for this medium supposed to be like? We set a launch date for the fall of 94. Jonathan Stoyer. I was the nerd getting a virtual reality PhD at Stanford. What pulled me over to Wired to start Hotwired was the data piece, to get interesting data about how people use media and new technologies. You have to pay college sophomores to do weird stuff for you. But on the Internet, people would leave logs. Brian Bellendorf. I knew enough about the protocols and the technology to understand that you could start to use this new technology that a couple of us had proposed called a cookie. Lou Montulli. The original design of cookies was specifically designed to be a tracking-free methodology, which is pretty ironic given how it is used today. The problem came about when cookies enabled tracking essentially by combining multiple technologies together to create a tracking technology. Howard Rheingold. So one of the things that we did do at Hotwired was to use forms, which had just become available, and cookies, which had just become available, to enable people to have forum-like conversations online. Louis Rossetto. We invented web media. For the first 6 months, we had 50% of the traffic on the web, some ridiculous number. Brian Bellendorf. We wanted to cultivate an online community where people actually had identities and talked to each other. Everything was the beginning point of a conversation, almost more of a BBS than a newspaper. Louis Rossetto. We separated it from Wired because we didn't want that idea that we're just repurposing content from Wired. We wanted these people to feel like they were doing something unique. Brian Bellendorf. As we were putting together this Hotwired division, Jonathan pulled together a lot of people he really respected from the digital world and from the BBS world. Howard Rheingold being one of those, Justin Hall being one of these. All of them were, like me, freaks. John Battelle. Weird, furry hacker freaks pushing the boundaries of the internet. Justin Hall. In December 1993, there were like 600 sites on the internet. They were all like, I'm at this university and I study advanced mathematical modeling, and here's a picture of my cat. I thought, boy, this can't be expensive or difficult. This guy's just put up a page about his cat. So I figured out how to put up a home page and launched it in January of 1994, and I introduced myself like I'd seen the sort of professory people do it. I said, hi, I'm Justin. I'm going to college. I love rock and roll music and LSD. I started just writing and using the hypertext structure of the web to tell the story of my life. Jane Metcalf. Justin was a bona fide internet personality. Joey Enough. Justin's Lynx.net was a bigger hit probably than anything Hotwired ever published. Howard Rheingold. Julie Peterson was the one who found Justin. She said, hey, I know you wanted to have a 19-year-old around. There's this guy at Swarthmore whose site is getting more traffic than Wired does. Justin Hall. I went to visit the Wired magazine offices at 2 South Park, and it was awesome. You know, just people with tattoos and long hair and earplugs. Like plugs in their ears, not like for sound, but for aesthetics. I had been to Grateful Dead shows, and I'd been to rock concerts, and I'd been to all kinds of stuff. But walking into the Wired office, you had the sense that all these different subcultures were converging. Brian Bellendorf. There were other people that we hired eventually who I knew through my connections on the SF Raves mailing list that I administered. The list was a gathering point that a lot of young creative people seemed to be attracted to. Jane Metcalf. I called them the happy shiny people, and they attracted more happy shiny people. They were good looking and fun and totally on board with whatever needed to happen. They knew how to manage parties. They knew how to manage the list and the front door and all the rest of that thing. Justin Hall. I met up with the online team for a while and we chatted. I can't really remember much of what we chatted about, except that at the very end, one of them said to me, if you're going to be the intern, you're going to have to smoke the swag weed. That's when I realized, oh my God, I think it's going to be okay. I'm going to fit in with these people. These are my people. I get it. Howard Rheingold. When Justin joined, we went downstairs. There was an interesting guy who had a little magazine called Might, Dave Eggers. Jack Boulware. South Park was a publishing hub. You might go to the burrito place for lunch, and, oh, there's the guys from Might magazine having a Gen X rap session about something. And then the Wired people would start floating in. Howard Rheingold. He had this little magazine, this little storefront down there. So we smoked a joint down there and went back into the office, and all eyes turned to us because we had smoked it at the base of the elevator shaft, and it just sucked all the smoke into the office. Justin Hall. The online people were in a space called the Grotto in the back of 2 South Park. It was called the Grotto because it was hot and it was far from the door and it was packed. I loved it, of course, because I was 19. I'm elbow to elbow with people who love the internet. Amy Krishit. Justin ended up sleeping in the Grotto for a summer. I gave him as a present once to a friend of mine for her birthday. A big bow, you know? So yeah, there was definitely some partying going on. John Battelle. Justin was in the Hotwired team, but whenever I interacted with him, I was struck by two things. that he was very smart and that he was like 10 years old. He was so thin and slight. Louis Rossetto. Justin was cool. He was this young guy who was full of ideas and energy, and I was happy to have him around. He had his own thing going, and he brought a lot of insight into the medium and to help launch Hotwired. We ultimately had a disagreement about a couple things. Justin Hall. I started arguing with Louis Rossetto about how the web should take shape and whether people should enjoy the web or whether the web was more exciting as a place where brands and curators should have the loudest voices. I was so worked up about the idea that individual publishing would be the ticket to happiness and a truly new medium. Louis was already feeling like the web was too unpolished for it to be popular, and that the web needed a firm hand to take shape as a truly great space for publications. Louis Rossetto.
Justin had just a sort of unwillingness to understand that the site needed to make money.
For him to have a job, the site needed to raise funds, and you need an advertiser for that. There was some kind of a disconnect between the business reality of it and what his ideals were about what the site should be. Gary Wolf. Howard and Justin, they had a vision of a future of the web in which anybody could say anything to anybody else, and in which platforms for enabling communities would be the new valuable form of media. And Lewis had a vision of the web in which the web would provide a mechanism by which popular voices could reach even larger audiences due to the erasure of distribution costs. Justin Hall. Lewis was very different than the people in the online department. It was fun to be able to sort of go hang out with the people that were all sort of psychedelic and communitarian, and then go to the other side of the office and argue with the guy who was, I'm trying to summon my best Lewis impression here, like, we're on a rocket ship to design expertise and content curation. Howard Rheingold. Lewis absolutely wanted to be Hugh Hefner, Jan Wenner, Helen Gurley Brown, the dictator of what culture is, not, as he put it, the bozo filter for the web. It came down to lots of everyday decisions. Can you see any of the content before you sign up and give us your email address? Or is there just a banner ad and you don't see anything more until you sign up? Louis Rossetto. We invented the banner ad. The stupidest thing we did was not patent that. We would have been centimillionaires for having done that. Justin Hall. Anyway, we had some philosophical differences. Brian Bellendorf. And it became personal for a lot of people. Gary Wolf. And a kind of war broke out between him and his staff. Howard Rheingold. So I quit. And Jonathan Stoyer quit, and a few other people did as well. Justin Hall. I said, well, I disagree, but whatever. I'm leaving in a month to go back to school. Louis Rossetto. One thing about media is that it is software that ships on time, and so at a certain moment, I just got completely frustrated with them. We were burning money, and no website is happening, and so I ended up replacing them. I just kicked them out. Gary Wolf. When I first walked in there, I felt this sense of a place where there already was some kind of hysterical, traumatic history. All the answers that you got when you asked a question were inflected with this kind of emotional sense of betrayal, and that's because I gathered later that there had already been some kind of a vision for what an online voice of Wired should be, and it was related probably somehow to both the utopian language that was accumulating around the early publicly accessible internet, and to Lewis's really over-the-top revolutionary proclamations. Justin Hall. You know, the Bengali typhoon? His ability to spool out hyperbole as a way to describe the oncoming rush of digital technology was historic. Louis Rossetto.
If you read the Bengali typhoon editorial, it's completely spot on.
It's probably not even a big enough metaphor. It's probably a comet hitting the planet. Gary Wolf. So you already had kind of an atmosphere of factionalism, and this is where the story starts, really. The story starts with attempting to create and launch the first commercial web publication. How would it support itself? Who would it be for? What would it look like? And that's really where I came in. Carl came in as a kind of webmaster. Production, I think we called him. Carl Stedman. I end up getting a job at Hotwired. They put me on the mailing list, and here I see this epic battle between employees on one side and someone called Louis Rossetto about T-shirts. Like, who should get a free T-shirt? If each employee deserves a free T-shirt. I could not believe that there was no sense of organizational structure. I couldn't believe that there were all these little brats. Gary Wolf. In this kind of crazy, hysterical microclimate, people who had 6 weeks of experience on the web comported themselves like captains of industry. You know, like, okay, I can make a paragraph break on the web. Therefore, I am king. And in a way, it was true, because
if you couldn't do that, you were sitting there saying, like, shoot, how do I get the paragraph to break?
Can anybody help me? Keep in mind, you can't just look it up on Google. Carl Stedman. There were hordes of young people who had found their first employer, who had no notion of how lucky they were and were completely undisciplined and couldn't get anything done. And I make no friends because things have to change. We have to get things done. Joey Enough. The thing about Hotwired is, there is the original Hotwired and there is late stage Hotwired, and I was late stage Hotwired. Because the original Hotwired, as far as I can understand it, were a group of people that sat around, smoked a lot of weed, and never did a damn thing. Carl Stedman. I think Hotwired, before I got there, took over a year to launch, and it was just ridiculous how nothing happened at that place. Gary Wolf. In the 2 years after I got to Hotwired, it went from about a dozen people to about 200 people. Jack Boulware. Hotwired was a massive website. It was far larger than anything else that had launched in terms of an online magazine publishing presence. They had so much money, and it was online only, and they were just scooping up people from these zines right and left to contribute to it. Gary Wolf. Lewis's goal in expanding so fast was to do clearly branded media voices across all the major categories that would soon become important on the web. He wanted entertainment and the arts. He wanted tech. He wanted political coverage. Louis Rossetto. So we set out to basically plant flags in a bunch of different areas, as many different areas as we possibly could. So we did travel sites. We did extreme sports sites. We did political sites. We did how-to sites. Jane Metcalf. How to mix cocktails. Gary Wolf. There was an art section. A music section. Louis Rossetto. The Beta Lounge was the first streaming music site. Jack Boulware. They were doing book reviews, which seems sort of ironic. I did a bunch of stories for them. They sent me to the Porn Academy Awards in Vegas. Gary Wolf. You never knew what the new assignment was going to be. Literally any idea that somebody had might catch fire, and the next thing you know, we were publishing that stuff. A disciplined organization, we were not. Louis Rossetto. The Hotwired site just grew like crabgrass. Every time he turned around, and there were another 20 people over there. A large part of the crew that's being assembled is coders, literally people writing code for all the things that needed to be done. The editorial systems, the ad management systems, the billing systems, none of them existed, and there was no place to go for them, so we had to write them ourselves. Brian Bellendorf. Before we launched, I had a direct line in with Lewis and everyone else building the thing, because I was the one kind of taking their ideas, and 6 hours later having a running prototype. That was a very rapid, highly iterative kind of thing. And that was a key part of why that effort felt creative. After the launch, after there was a lot of attention and a lot of traffic and suddenly advertisers and such, and understandably it skewed to be more of a business-driven kind of operation. But I think too quickly they moved into a mode that dropped off a lot of the engineers from the decision-making and the C-suite. I did not stick around and fight for engineering to be better represented at the top. Carl Stedman. So I'm at Hotwired. I ended up running engineering when engineering left. But keep in mind that I don't just have a technical background. I also have an editorial background, and I've got a design background as well. There's no clear reason why I am locked out of meetings which could determine the direction.